Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
I'm Roger Madeline, and I am the head of Canada Water Development at British Land.
Many architects start their career dreaming of their perfect commission, perhaps the chance of creating an iconic building that defines a city. Few architects, though, get the opportunity to totally redefine and reshape whole swathes of a city. My guest this week is not an architect, but a developer, having made his name at Argent through his acclaimed urban regeneration work, initially at Brindley Place in Birmingham, and then through the vast transformation of King's Cross in London. King's Cross has become a defining example of bold, well-managed urban regeneration. In the early 1980s, Roger studied building management and engineering at university before entering the world of work in the midst of a deep recession. In 1987, he joined the fledgling developer Argent. 2 years later, he became a director and went on to become chief executive in 1997. Roger was awarded a CBE for services to sustainable development in the 2007 Queen's Honours List. In 2010, he became an honorary fellow of the RIBA. Last year, Roger left Argent to join the FTSE 100 developer British Land, where he's now leading the exciting transformation of 46 acres of land in Canada Water, in southeast London. I joined Roger at British Land's offices in Mayfair, where I started by asking about his early interest above the cities rather than in them.
You, I've read somewhere, wanted to be a pilot when you were younger.
I wanted to be a paid pilot.
A paid pilot.
I am a pilot.
You are a pilot.
I've been a pilot
wow.
Since I've been 16, which is quite a long time ago.
Okay. So as a private pilot's license, you still are?
I was a glider pilot,
okay.
Still am, hang glider pilot, biplane pilot, and a hot air balloon pilot.
You weren't involved in the hot air ballooning the weekend? You're from
No, I wasn't. I haven't been up in the hot air balloon I share with my brother for 18 months or so. He's been up in it regularly. He's just come back from Italy, actually, so...
Wow, that's
I've spent several thousand hours in the air.
That's a
feet off the ground is, you know.
A serious interest in,
serious
in,
interest,
in aviation.
No one wanted to pay me for doing it.
Right, okay. So you tried for the RAF.
I tried for the RAF. I passed the selection tests, and then it was dependent on the medical, and my eyes were borderline.
Okay.
And they upped the criteria.
Right.
Because they had lots of people who wanted to be pilots at that time.
Yeah.
So I then tried for British Airways and they upped the criteria because lots of pilots, lots of people wanted to be pilots. I guess it was a bulge in teenage boys mainly.
Yeah. Right.
And then I tried for Bristow Helicopters.
Okay.
And exactly the same. I got through to the last 18 out of 1,500. The university term had started.
Right.
And I had no place at university. And
okay.
I came back from failing the eyesight test for Bristow Helicopters. And my dad said, don't worry, I've got a place at university for you doing civil engineering at Aston.
Okay.
And I kind of vaguely knew where Aston was, but not quite.
Okay.
So off I went in the car with him, loaded up, and arrived at Aston to start civil engineering.
And was civil engineering something you had, you'd studied previously?
I was doing geography, maths and physics at A level, which is the kind of pilot's ones that are suggested, and the only careers advice I had when they asked, do you want to sit in an office, and the answer is no. They say, well, why don't you be a civil engineer? But that's as far as it got.
Right.
Yeah, I was always kind of aware of interesting bridges, but never particularly thought to be a civil engineer. But anyway, I stopped civil engineering after 2 weeks.
Right.
Because it was very, very difficult. And
I was
3 weeks into the term.
Okay.
And if you sit in a soil mechanics lecture 3 weeks into the term with one of the top Polish soil mechanics scientists and think, I'm not going to be in the top handful of people in this class, I said, have you got any other courses? And they said, yeah, we got mechanical engineering, production engineering, you could do building, building economics. I went, what's building? So I did building. I think it was then called building management and engineering or something, but then they stopped the course a few years later. And it's done
after
it.
After me.
After it was a great success. It was a great success. I've used absolutely everything I did at university in my job. Absolutely everything from concrete cancer to glass reinforced concrete to soil mechanics to bentonite slurry and contiguous diaphragm walling, of which there's an example just over the road from this building I was showing everyone the other day. The whole lot, and marketing and law and everything. Brilliant course, absolutely brilliant.
That's quite rare, do you think, for people who?
Shouldn't be, should it?
No,
you know, like going to university and doing something that's useful is, probably shouldn't be a revelation, should it?
I mean, you could maybe talk to architects a lot and find architects coming out without a huge amount of business experience. Maybe do you find the kind of if that's the one thing we can talk about architectural education.
I think generally, there isn't enough applied real world stuff in any course. You don't have to go mad.
No.
You do need people to be creative and enjoy themselves and think outside the box and all that. But Aston was very good in that it had people from the industry used to come in and tell stories about their jobs or certain other people's jobs or that was very relevant.
You said then in civil engineering you realised maybe you weren't going to be the top three in your class. There's a kind of
top handful. Come on, right.
But there's an ambition there early on. Clearly, do you think?
I suppose there is really. Yeah. I kind of like being towards the front.
Yeah.
Thinking, I could probably overtake the front. Usually I can't. you just kind of think, well, maybe if I tried a bit harder, I could.
And so very quickly you came out of university, you worked for a...
It was a sandwich course, so industrial placement, and wasn't that lucky because I came out in 1981, which was quite a deep recession.
Yeah. So who did you work, who was that year?
Kyle Stewart gave me work during university, so six months at on-site and then 6 months university, and then it was 9 months with Carl Stewart, 3 months quantity surveying, which was, you could do that in the first couple of hours in the morning, and then I went back out on-site. And then the last 6 months placement was in estimating and planning, which was very interesting. And then straight after graduation, assistant general foreman, assistant contracts manager, senior contracts manager.
All in a couple of weeks.
It was all in a few years because, of course, one of the advantages if you are young and therefore cheaper than most, if you can do the job and more expensive people get made redundant, quite sad. But I had two bosses that just disappeared
because of the recession.
And I ended up doing their job.
Right.
And no one asked me how old I was. I was a senior contracts manager at 25. The only person that knew was the car manager that kept giving me, upgraded cars, and I kept smashing them.
Might come back onto that after. There's a story there. And then fairly quickly onto development. You joined 86, 87?
85. I joined a developer called Sherfield Investments that were described as an innovative developer in the Thames Valley. They were started by a lawyer that wanted his own office building and developed it himself, and then found that very exciting. And when I joined about 2 years after they'd finished that office, we had 23 developments in conception. We had 500,000 square feet of speculative building under construction.
Wow.
We employed all of our labour directly. We owned eight dump trucks, and we went bust because there was more money going out than coming in. But Michael and Peter Freeman, who had set up Argent as a TV production company in 1981, had found that very difficult, and it turned into Argent Estates because they owned a house in Islington that they were converting into apartments.
Right.
And they got the bug as well, and they found it quite difficult to move from sort of planning and getting options on sites, you know, to actually signing up a building contractor. And they also found it difficult finding new opportunities.
Yeah.
And so acquiring this company I was working for, you know, could have been very good for them, because right. you know, out of the 20 odd projects we had at conception, you know, half a dozen were quite good.
Right.
So they looked to do a deal with the receiver, and that's how I met Michael. That's how I met Michael and Peter in 1986.
Okay.
We weren't meant to go bust Sherfield, but but we did. You know, cash flow was just, you know, diabolical. And Michael and Peter said, "Would I like to come and try and take forward some of the jobs that this old company had, and also look at some of the jobs they were looking at?" And kind of the rest is history. So I joined Argent in January the 15th, 1987. Deep snow. Yeah. Deep snow, because I'd just come back from hang gliding in South America.
Wow, okay.
Not having been paid for 3 months. Yep, so I was, you know, that's an interesting developer. Well, that developer, Sherfield, that went bust, that 500,000 square feet of spec space was let, fully let, before completion, all of it,
and
to IBM, Digital, that are now Fujitsu, Microsoft, companies called Telematics, Armdahl, you know, all the big kind of names in computer hardware and software. And it was quite an interesting time. And you just kind of learn that, you know, even if you de-risk by letting these buildings, you know, you've just got to watch the cash flow.
Yeah. And those, I mean, kind of speculative buildings for those sorts of new I guess at the time then kind of new firms.
They were new firms, very exciting.
What sort of things were they, I mean, were they after, you know, people talk about the kind of floor plates now and some new buildings for Google and things. And
well, guess what they were talking about? They were talking about adaptability. They were talking about flexibility. They were talking about not quite knowing how much space they wanted and you know, being able to expand and contract.
Yeah.
They were talking about
different
uses within the same, you know, building volume.
Okay.
They were talking about possibly double height space and possibly putting in mezzanines. You know, they were talking about work-life balance. They were talking about health and fitness.
Yeah.
And,
that's come around.
It's 30 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah.
And these planning, there was a new planning regime in for high-tech development. The use classes changed because the Thatcher government recognised that, you know, just defining offices and light industrial
wasn't
quite there, so they brought in the new use class that's become B1. So that was all part of, not quite sure whether this is an industrial building or an office building.
Right. And was that in London? Were you in London?
No, it was in the Thames Valley, so Basingstoke.
Reading and that.
It was, I'm just trying to think, it was Basingstoke, Dogmersfield, which is near Basingstoke.
Okay.
Bit in Camberley. We were looking at some stuff in Winchester.
Right.
But around that kind of M3 corridor.
Yeah. And so Argent were, what, sort of five, six people then when you joined? A really
Michael,
small...
Peter, Jane, now my wife.
Right, okay.
Ruth, receptionist, she just arrived.
Yeah.
And Carol, who my wife employed because she didn't want to be in the office on her own, and she didn't think the business plan was very sufficient, so she helped them write a new business plan, which was go and get some, you know, more projects.
Yeah, clever business plan, and that worked, obviously. I mean, you...
It was a very close-knit team, you know, and that's the way it stayed for the next three decades.
And when you left Argent, do you remember what the headcount was? How many were you...
127, and I think it's now 154.
Okay. But contractors not, you know, being employed kind of externally, presumably?
No,
all still.
Okay. All employed, yeah, it's Argent related now.
Okay.
My old colleagues teamed up with the big private American developer related. They're expanding.
Okay. And so I guess then King's Cross is the big project, you know, to talk about.
A big project, yes.
One of the big projects, but I mean the one for which you're, I guess, known at
Well, only because are too young. What about Brindley Place? You know, what about Thames Valley Park?
Oh, well,
what about
Green Park? This is the London Festival of Architecture, so I guess we're talking about London. But
don't mention Manchester, though.
Yeah. Okay. Brindley Park, I mean, that was...
Brindley Place.
At Brindley Place in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
The first kind of big... I mean,
traditionally master plan, new piece of city in Western Europe since Wagner's Vienna in 1905.
Right, okay.
According to Dmitry Porfiriev.
And that, I mean... A lot of the architects we've spoken to have, I guess, gone into architecture and dreamed of creating their own buildings and their own iconic buildings. And you've gone into development and, I guess, seen new parts of cities created. You know, was that ever a vision, you know, a dream? You know, at what stage did the sort of regeneration bug bite?
When I was working for the building contractor, Kyle Stewart, they're now BAM.
They went right.
Kyle okay. Stewart, then HBG, I think, and now they're BAM. You know, and I still, King's Cross is, and Argent are still working with them. And, you know, I was with the chief exec, you know, the other week, and, you know, we're talking to them about Canada Water. So, you know, a number of people that were there, even when I was working there, are still there, you know, so those relationships, you know, are very, very strong and there's great, great respect. But when I was working for them, I got very intrigued, frustrated and annoyed, probably in equal measure, about what happened before the poor old contractor, you know, was told to start digging. And then had, you know, an increasingly small amount of time to finish a building. 44 weeks, I remember, was the last job I had to deliver. And I just became aware that some years before the contractor was brought on board, and you think, well, who was managing that? And why did they design this building that's not very good? And yeah, they could have done a lot better than this, surely. And you know, who was managing that process up front? And particularly through hang gliding, I had been traveling through Europe and spending time in urban places, you know, in Spain and Italy and France, and just thinking these places feel really nice. You know, you're sat in the bar, or you go to the boulangerie in the morning, and you think, what is it about these urban spaces that just feel so much better than anywhere I've been in the UK. And
I suppose that's hard now for people, you know, certainly in London, to quite, you know, now that London's kind of, you know, spread of outdoor places and bars and cafes.
Yeah, there was to say there was no one in London in the 80s and 90s eating outside is probably a bit extreme, but it was very rare.
Yeah.
And also from Brindley Place, to put a restaurant under an office building.
Yeah.
I think Argent at Brindley Place was probably the first sane developer to do it through choice. You know, when we did the Stanton Williams building for Brindley Place and we put a big restaurant under it, of course we designed it to, you know, be offices as well. But we were told by the profession that if there were 20 owning institutions of that size of office building, 18 of them would not even look at that building because it had a restaurant on the ground floor.
Wow.
And everyone finds that really hard to believe. Yeah. If you don't put a restaurant on the ground floor now, you probably won't get planning. Yeah. You know, so, but all of those things I saw in traveling around. Birmingham in the late 70s, and very early 80s was a very interesting place. Yeah. You know, just the urban decay and walking through the jewellery quarter and looking at what they'd done, you know, to Inner Ring Road and all the underpasses and the
roads
high aspiration, you know, to do something amazing in the 60s. You know, I just became fascinated by who was making these decisions and, you know, why some of them worked and some of them were very bad.
Did you see them as mistakes at the time? You know, some of the kind of road infrastructure projects.
You could see in the jewellery quarter, you know, which was now derelict, other than the odd bar that was, you know, popping up, that something needed to happen dramatically in Birmingham to stop this urban decay. The roads and the underpasses, as a student were quite exciting because, you know, yeah. I'd never been to anywhere quite like it. But you knew, unless you were, you know, a kind of young, tough, testosterone-filled male, walking around there was probably
dangerous.
Yeah, a little bit dangerous. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's stories of people getting knifed and axes in heads and chased through underpasses. Yeah. I got chased through a few underpasses. Yeah, you could sense
the danger,
that it was gritty and urban and dangerous. And but for a late teens, early 20s, you know, it was exciting.
Yeah.
But you knew it was not a good place.
And the same, I guess, can be said then about King's Cross before that.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And I went up to King's Cross in the mid-late 80s when it was making the press, and I just couldn't believe it. It was just amazing. It was anarchy in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, there were kids with tricycles and flower boxes on windowsills. And then during the day, you know, it was kind of hippie, you know, some kind of paradise. Yeah. And then you go up there at night, just
transformed.
Prostitutes were every few meters. Yeah. And it was like a film set. It was extraordinary. And I just was fascinated in going around King's Cross and watching the big development proposals of the late 80s and early 90s. So when it was coming back on the market in the late 90s, I was straight up there again, and not a lot of change.
No,
I had kind of swept most of the prostitutes off the streets, but big drug problem up there, very sad.
Michael Squire was talking, interviewed a couple of weeks ago.
Well, just outside his office, I walked around with Inspector Buttercase here, and he lifted up
hypodermic needles and everything else.
And there are loads of kind of wallets, in drains, this policeman lifted up. He knew where all the hypodermics were and all the spoons were and all the little cigarette lighters. And But yeah, you just think, what a great place to develop. This can only go one way, can't go down.
And it has,
A bit like Birmingham, Let's find somewhere that can go only one way. Of course, Canada Water is great as it is, but
we'll come onto Canada Water now. But I mean, I guess the other linked thing really is the linked, maybe Britain's attitude to heritage has changed. You know, certainly around that time, Manhattan Loft Corporation. You know, some of the kind of loft living, some of the stuff Urban Splash were doing. I mean, one of the things that's really marked King's Cross is it's the heritage buildings that have been kept there. And I guess at the time, developers would perhaps have bulldozed the place and put new things up. So that was a big change in terms of, do you think, Britain's respect for its heritage, for its kind of urban landscape, for its...
I'm certainly aware it was a big change compared to some of the things that had happened in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and even through the 90s. And obviously Ken Livingstone wanted to have a battle with English heritage, which I think was probably the right thing to do. But like all these things, he took it to extreme and said some silly things. And, they're always great people in English heritage, who were pragmatic and visionary. But there were some preservationists. And so Ken was quite funny sometimes. I think he did have a twinkle in his eye when he said to me, if you want a hand knocking down all those horrible old buildings, let me know and I'll help you. And I said to Ken, well, don't think we want to knock any of them down, actually, because they're all actually built very strongly, and they're all kind of rectangular. They're all used for industry. They're quite easily convertible to other uses.
Yeah.
And he said, well, kind of, that's fine. And I said, well, if they were all knocked down, we'd be scratching our head and coming up with 20 master plans and trying to work out how to create something different and a bit of character.
But was that, I mean, was it a kind of pragmatic decision that the buildings were sound, or was it a kind of visionary decision that they would be just, they'd add character, that they would
It wasn't visionary. I think a lot of people around that time were getting into senior positions.
Right.
And had seen London change from the 80s, you know, through the 90s, from a kind of you can't do that to, well, why not do that? And no one told me that, you know, knocking down old buildings, you know, was a good thing to do. And you walk around those old buildings, which I did a lot, and you just thought, wow, these are amazing. And if I like them, that means someone else is going to like them. And they are quite usable. And I, you know, I walk around a lot with Paddy Pugh from English Heritage and a lot of people from kind of heritage interest groups. And I think quite a lot, I was always at least as excited as them. And sometimes I was more excited than them. And I remember one of them saying, you know, well, you're going to have to knock this down, aren't you, Roger? And I went, no, I don't think so. I think we could use it. And they're going like, are you sure? Economically, I went, yeah, that'd be all right. You know, big old strong walls. And, and there was a real dialogue, you know, between English Heritage and us and, you know, the Victorian Society as well, that just wanted to see how many of them we could keep and what we could do with them. It was it was an excitement. But there was, we did a few schemes where some of the heritage, you know, was removed, some of it. And it was only when we decided to keep, you know, everything. I know the Colross building went and one of the Stanley buildings went, but it was only when we decided to keep everything and put the gas holder frames back up that actually the master plan clicked into place. Yeah, I'm finding this at Canada Water. If you've got a blank sheet of paper, you could go to 20 architects, good architects, and they'd come up with 20 master plans. They'd all be different. They'd all argue they're good, and I'm sure they would be good. But you kind of think, is there's something missing, you know, what is it about this master plan for this area that you go, wow, that is King's Cross or Canada Water? And it was only when we decided to keep everything, you know, to the north of the canal, that the master plan kind of, oh, that works, blimey, that works, and it's King's Cross, and you know, we're going to work around the heritage. And we've got a similar situation at Canada Water, which I'll tell you about in a sec.
We'll come on to that. And I suppose then, you know, given the size of King's Cross, you're talking about some of the work with Ken. I mean, the big change for, you know, some developers working on smaller schemes, you know, individual buildings, to, you know, to huge parts of a city, I guess, is the engagement, the necessary engagement with government and with the mayor's office and local authorities. That, you know, is there a change, do you think, to that kind of government, public-private partnership, you know, in terms of the way things are now built? Just interested in how you develop those relationships.
I think there was a change. You know, I won't bore you with my rationale for that long, other than to say Mrs. Thatcher said the public sector were bad, the private sector were good. Obviously, you know, that wasn't as black and white as that, but she certainly shook things up. John Major came in and said, no, actually, you know, public-private partnerships are the way forward. You know, we're going to have to work together, which kind of worked but got slagged off a bit. And then Tony Blair came in and everyone thought, he's going to get rid of it, and he rejuvenated it. And public and private sector people around the table, you know, if they're good, you know, visionary, pragmatic people, you know, they're exactly the same. You know, you can't, you know, there's not, you know, different uniforms and stuff like that. And working together is, you know, usually a lot better than, you know, working against each other. And so I have always found that, you know, if you can create a dialogue, whether people are from the local authority or the city office or politicians, you know, if you can find common kind of aspiration, and then use each other's skills where appropriate, it's much more fun. You know, it's much better. And I don't think, you know, that collaboration is here to stay.
Allies and Morrison then were behind a lot of the, they were behind the master plan, were they, in King's Cross? Were they?
Perforis Associates and Allies and Morrison.
Right. Okay.
And I think it is fair to say that neither had done a big master plan in the UK, if they'd done any master planning. And the reason I decided to put them together as master planners was because, as Architects for Individual Buildings at Brindley Place, I had found their dialogue, their constructive criticism, and just, you know, their company great at Brindley Place.
Yeah.
So, you know, they would really constructively criticise their own schemes, you know, and each other's schemes and other architect schemes who were brought on. And I took the decision before we put our kind of final submission in for King's Cross that we weren't going to win King's Cross by producing a draft master plan. And for two reasons. One, I wasn't going to get my colleagues' support to spend a few hundred grand designing a master plan, but you didn't have to spend that long going around King's Cross to realise it was seriously complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way you could do a proper brief to anyone until, you know, you had fully understood, you know, the physical constraints, mm-hmm. you know, technical constraints, and then, you know, let alone the planning policy mm-hmm. constraints. So I decided that, you know, our bid would be very much, you know, we are going to assemble a team of people that with others, mm-hmm. you know, will form an informed dialogue, and we will progressively, you know, get more information. And this isn't about architecture. You know, the master mm-hmm. plan is about a framework for buildings yeah. to then come into that framework. And there was one side of me that knew some people in CABE were very interested in more contemporary buildings,
mm.
and some people were very, yeah, the kind of Prince Charles School were very interested in the kind of Dimitri School.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of me that said, well, that will confuse the buggers, wouldn't it? Because yeah, if they are silly enough to think it's about architecture
yeah.
at this stage,
yeah.
Yeah, it's win-win, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because they've become, and it absolutely worked, because people said, oh, you've got Bob and Graham, you know, yeah. that's good, yeah. and then, you know, the Prince Charles group said, well, Dimitri, you know, will come up with something good. Yeah. You know, he understands yeah. cities yeah. and buildings.
Yeah.
But, of course, it wasn't about the design of individual buildings. And Bob and Graham and Dimitri, yeah, we had great fun deciding what other architects to come in and test the building plots that had evolved from the master plan framework. And some of those, you know, have gone on to do buildings. You know,
yeah.
So the Chipperfield and the Eric Parry sketch designs, you know, were done in 2003, 2004.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Eric's building, you know, is exactly yeah. the same as his original sketch. I think he was completely shocked yeah. when he was phoned in 2013 and went, Eric, you know, remember that building you designed at King's Cross? Yeah. Like,
which one
really?
Yeah.
I haven't designed anything. yeah, you have. Yeah. Actually, we just have that.
Yeah.
And yeah, a lot of the architects, yeah. you know, that did feasibilities, you know, then went on to do buildings.
I mean, I suppose
not all of them, but
at the time there wasn't a lot of experience of urban master planning. I mean, obviously new towns, the kind of Milton Keynes and things had been kind of planned, but urban master planning in the UK was still relatively new then, do you think?
Certainly led by the private sector, yes.
Yeah.
You know, there had been, you know, huge examples in the 60s and 70s and Barbican, you know, driven by municipalities, let's call them municipalities. And I'm sure some of them, you know, were very good.
Yeah.
But the private sector, I'm not saying, you know, the private sector, you know, was going to do something better, because, you know, a lot of the shopping centres and town centres, you know, were very much led by the private sector.
Yeah.
But I think that opportunity at King's Cross was genuinely unique,
yeah.
you know, to have 56 acres of developable land in one ownership with no one living, you know,
yeah.
so you didn't have to
there wasn't any
go through
moving
that
people
whole
out or
political
or,
process
yeah.
of,
okay.
you know, these are people's homes, you know, they
yeah.
don't want to move. That was very unique, and you know, we used to say that's the largest piece of central London
yeah.
available to be master planned, you know, for I think Paul Finch said for 154
yeah.
years. That was about 10 years ago. And we said, what was that then, Paul? And he went, I don't know, you know, one of the great estates
yeah.
probably had
a
chunk of land. I think
he'd done his research,
you know,
Paul.
Paul's
sure,
always
yeah.
done his research, hasn't he? So.
And then the move then, I mean, from Argent to British Land, Was that, I mean, things were, I guess, in train in King's Cross. Was it just the excitement, you know, the excitement of something new? Was it the, what was the, British Land still a much bigger, I mean, a FTSE 100 company, a kind of even then a bigger developer than Argent. What swung you into, you know, that was, you know, all that time at Argent to...
Well, Argent has been through many corporate phases. When I joined Michael and Peter, the finance was from one, then two, and then three private investors.
Right.
And we expanded the development activities in the 80s to the point that we had, I think, 11 developments on site. We just survived, you know, 89, 90 recession. You know, right. Cash flow was the only real item on the board agenda. You know, they very kindly put me on the board at the end of 88. So, you know, I experienced
that tough
89, 90, which was, you know, a huge, huge learning curve for all of us. And then an investor came in, Warburg Pincus, the private venture bank from New York. Mm. To fundamentally buy investment properties, which we did. And then we went on the stock market, which was interesting. But Michael, Peter and me and, you know, the team that, you know, was joining, development is a great privilege. You know, and, you know, if you can do it, you know, if you have done it, you kind of tend to want to do more, yeah. provided you know, it's been reasonably successful. And Brindley Place... we got just before we floated, and Thames Valley Park just after we floated. And for 18 months, you know, having that extra money, you know, did enable us to, you know, roll out development. And we thought, oh, this is great. But yeah. we did know that the stock market wasn't necessarily a good place to be, because they always want, you know, growth. And they, you know, we've had a good year, we have another good year, won't you? Well, development doesn't kind of work like that.
Yeah.
And so we delisted. That's a trendy way of... calling. Argent delisted in 97 and I became chief exec, and
so it became privately
big investors in the development program was Hermes, British Telecom Pension Scheme, and Alistair Rossgooby, the late Alistair Rossgooby, who ran Hermes, knew that development done well and getting the timing right, you know, was
a longer term,
could be something good, and he agreed to put £100 million on Argent's balance sheet and basically let us run independently, subject to a few rules.
Yeah.
And I think that was the best, you know, structure for any developer in the UK. So Argent went from being a, you know, a FTSE 250 property company to solely a developer.
Yeah.
And we won, you know, more schemes in Birmingham, more schemes in Manchester, you know, Green Park, and then we won King's Cross. And then in 2007, before the financial crisis, British Telecom Pension Scheme decided that they didn't want to invest through Argent to take it forward. They had put another £200 million into King's Cross, which was very helpful when 2008 came. And so the business needed restructuring.
Right.
And that last £100 million was spent into 2012. It had all gone. Argent became a limited liability partnership, a development manager for King's Cross and for other business.
Right.
And I said I would step back from deciding what structure the company wanted to move forward, because, you know, I was 56 or whatever, and some of the younger partners, you know, clearly were going to be there longer than me. And they decided to team up with Related, a great American developer doing Hudson Yard. And you know, fundamentally, you know, as development managers, you know, with a little bit of skin in the game, but no money on the balance sheet. So I spent the next 3 years on certain aspects of King's Cross.
Yeah.
I went down to 4 days a week, looked at some interesting things with interesting people, flew for 1 day, I think, and then... You know, oh, could you come and have a look at this and come and have a look at that? And I'd always wanted Argent to be involved in a new settlement. Mm-hmm. And one of the last things that, you know, I was at the helm of was we bid for Aldershot. Argent bid for Aldershot, 4,500 homes. And we got to one of three and we didn't win it. Granger won it. Yeah. You know, we didn't offer the most money, you know, that that error.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Argent had looked at other potential new settlements. But, you know, for various reasons, it wasn't right. And so I spent my day not working at Argent travelling around. So I've been to some quite interesting places.
Yeah.
Bicester, York, Swindon, Basingstoke, Borden, Ebbsfleet, Old Oak Common.
Yeah.
And for all sorts of reasons, I thought this isn't right. My wife said, so if you're going to get a job, you know, what are the criteria? And we seriously wrote down 10 criteria. It happened to be 10.
Yeah.
And I'd known Chris Grigg at British Land for a while. You know, we'd had cups of coffee over the years. You know, he'd tentatively looked at could he, you know, buy into King's Cross a while ago. I'd looked at some British Land projects. Yeah. Everyone I knew at British Land, you know, were nice people. I'd never heard a bad thing about them. And Chris bought me a cup of coffee and said, have you found your new town yet? And I went, nope. He went, I got one for you. Yeah. And I genuinely thought he was going to say, you know, we've got million square, you know, square feet or 1,000 acres in Cambridge or Oxford or something. And he said, no, he said, I've got Canada Water. And I was kind of disappointed. I went, oh, yeah, I know you've got something over there.
Yeah.
I said, how much you got? He said, 46 acres. And I went, blimey, when did you get that? And he went, well, we bought the last bit in March 2015. Right. And I went, oh, done a master plan. And he went, yeah, kind of. One's come together, not quite sure whether it's right. So to cut a long story short, I went, I spent 3 weeks travelling there, talking to people, spent half a day there with my wife, cycled in different directions. And I just thought this is, in some ways, in some ways, more exciting than King's Cross. Mm-hmm. Overall, it's, you know, it's as exciting as King's Cross, but for very different reasons.
And those 10... the 10
criteria,
the 10 criteria for
arrogant
your...
criteria. Yeah.
Do you remember any of them?
What absolutely, yeah. I wanted to be able to cycle to work.
Right.
The place where I arrived at, you know, had to have decent cycle storage facilities. Didn't want to get killed on my bike.
No.
Cycling to work. Yeah. I wanted to work for a company that had, you know, money and a reputation that, you know, was good.
Yeah.
You know, I knew where the money was. Yeah. And in some ways, British Land is for me more like Argent 20 years ago, because it's got a big balance sheet. You know, Canada Water is a separate development, and if I come up with a good reason for requiring £1 billion, you know, I will at least have a good audience listening.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be big enough that you could create a place and you could evolve a master plan that could be delivered in economically viable phases.
Yeah.
I wanted something that was supported from a planning policy point of view. I wanted something that we could start from the beginning in terms of, you know, design and master planning. Now, you know, there had been some good work done, but I chose to put that in the bottom drawer for a while just to kind of think from the beginning. And, you know, I wanted to be able to create my own team of people, you know, working in the style that I wanted to work, and you know, all of those criteria were met
together.
I don't know, that's nine or eight or whatever, but yeah, I
can't ask for more than that. And so, I mean, I suppose some of the there's the Canada Water Library, which is slight, was that in your term?
No, that was before.
You know, the Jubilee Line extension, you know, I guess all of these things kind of coming together then for Canada Water. The big difference, I guess, is people living in Canada Water.
No one on our 46 and a half acres, though.
Right, okay. So that's the Print Works, that's the...
Surrey Quays Shopping Centre and Surrey Quays Leisure Park and the dock offices. We bought the dock offices last September.
Okay.
So we can get
vacant... So no one needing to be moved.
We can get vacant possession of the whole of the 46 and a half acres, other than Tesco's, and we will. We are working with Tesco's to do a new store for them.
Okay. And then...
Allies and Morrison again. Yeah, we did bring in Dimitri Porphyrios. He helped us with some studies and thinking outside the box a bit. I think that made us look at certain things differently. But back to Allies and Morrison exclusively earlier this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. I think it's a good master plan.
Yeah.
I keep looking at it and testing it, and it's kind of it's a robust urban plan, I think, you know, that's going to allow us to do some very interesting buildings. And
over the next, what's the kind of time scale then for Canada Water?
Hopefully the first phase will start early 2019, so we could have people living and working and visiting from 2022,
right,
maybe 2021.
Yeah.
And that first phase can be big. British Land Board have told me don't be afraid to have a big first phase. So at the moment, subject to, the first phase could be over £1 billion of construction, which is quite big. That's quite a big first phase.
You've talked about your experience in kind of some of the downturn of the early 80s. I guess the big thing kind of in the property industry is Brexit at the moment. Are you worried? Are you, in terms of will London just outgrow?
I'm worried for Britain about Brexit. London isn't going to suddenly stop doing business overnight. There's lots of great things about London particularly. There's slightly less great things about Britain particularly, if we don't remain open to people and international investment and ideas, and we start becoming more bureaucratic, which you can kind of sense already, we're going to become more bureaucratic. So I worry generally, the economy is not going to grow as fast, which is not great, and it's already not growing as fast. Whether we go into recession depends on how much of a pig's ear is made of what's going on at the moment. But there's a lot of people in London. There's a lot of momentum in London, which, can't just be turned off. And provided we don't start getting rid of people, although clearly there are some people making the choice to go elsewhere, we will respond to the market demand. And there's a lot of office occupiers looking for something a bit different, possibly a little bit more cost effective, possibly more adaptable, more flexible, a better place to work. What does that mean? Easy to get to, great place for the employees, health and well-being is at the top of everyone's agenda, maybe places to live and stay. So
many of the same things that came up when you're talking about IBM and things at the beginning.
Yes, but I've been involved in development for now over 30 odd years in a lot of interesting schemes. But even at King's Cross, when the buildings were coming out of the ground, and even at King's Cross today, there are more potential occupiers talking to us seriously about Canada Water than I've ever had in any scheme at any stage. Now, Thames Valley, Birmingham, Manchester and King's Cross, not one office letting took place until speculative buildings were coming out of the ground.
Right.
There was a conversation with Sainsbury's at King's Cross, but that didn't happen. So why have I had 20 businesses come to Canada Water? A lot. And eight of those are serious to the point where we are sketching proposals for them. These are not just
big companies,
low-level people looking for something to do. These are people serious on the board, partners, chief executives. And that is great. It's great talking to your customers, your end users, Yeah, and they all want.
Is that a more kind of enlightened view from occupiers then wanting to get in a bit earlier and shape? There's, I guess, a lot of talk about organisations like Google kind of specifying more what they want from a building. Is that?
Yeah, it's not just the building. I think that's the amazing opportunity at Canada Water. We've got 46.5 acres, but we connect directly into 120 acres of park, woodland and dock. So we've got 166 acres. Seriously, people go, here you go again, Martin. But we've got 64-acre Southwark Park. It's got tennis courts,
right,
athletics
track on its doorstep.
Fantastic. And from a employee getting to work point of view, you know, it's better than a lot of places in you know, other parts of central London because of that you know, amazing crossover of the Overground and the Jubilee line, you know, and the shape that those lines do, you know.
Yeah, they connects north and south and east and west.
Yeah, I know. It's just, you know, it's that
shape. I guess that kind of, you know, talking, has been a lot of talk recently about bridges over the Thames. You know, there's sort of talk about the Rotherhithe cycling bridge.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, I think Canary Wharf are anti it now because you know, they think too many cyclists will use it. I think, yeah, it's like outrageous. You know, like, what do we do with all those arriving in Canary Wharf? You know, well, probably most of your occupiers, mate, yeah.
They're worried about people cycling the other way, maybe into Canada water.
Oh yeah, well maybe you've hit the nail on the head there. Yeah,
that's great. I know we need to start just sort of rounding up. Just a couple of quick things I wanted just to run through. One, I guess we're seeing a lot more architects now looking at maybe changing their business models a little bit. You know, becoming more developers themselves in a small way. You know, on buildings and perhaps looking for alternative business models. Anything you might, you know, I guess you've spent a lot of your career working with architects, and you might say to architects looking to get in on the development side to be architect and developer.
Go for it.
Go for it.
Great. Yeah. It's great privilege. Yeah. Be careful.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Are the two...
One building's a great privilege. You know, you're doing a King's Cross or a Canada Water, it's a responsibility as well as a privilege, but great fun. Yeah, there's, I know quite a few architects that have done, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket, you know, don't buy land at the top of the market,
right?
Don't borrow too much money, you know, usual business things, but blooming heck, go for it, you know.
Great. And then finally, maybe any other parts of London, we've talked, you know, to a few of the guests on the podcasts about other places they find. You talked a bit about some of your kind of travel and some of the influences on your work. But any other parts of London you find inspirational, or you'd advise people to? You'd obviously advise people to start having a look around Canada Water. But any other parts of London you find?
Every day, not quite every day, I discover a new place, because I do tend to use similar routes, but quite often, you know, I will go right and then left and then you know, come back, just wonder what's down there. I think one of the many great things about, you know, having another large piece of London to get to know, is not only, you know, I discovered a huge amount about, you know, Rotherhithe and Bermondsey and, you know, Surrey Docks and the history and all of that neighbourhood. It's travelling to it, you know, because I usually cycle every day. I've just cycled back from Canada Water, and you know, I cycle from Richmond to Canada Water, and there are some amazing places in Southwark, you know, south of the river. You know, I know everyone knows Bermondsey now and Bermondsey High Street, but you know, everyone knows Bermondsey Spa, do they? I don't know, but you know, just keep going, you know, keep going into Peckham, you know, and keep going around Millwall, and you know, and come back towards Surrey Docks, you know, and then go through the Rotherhithe Peninsula. It is bloody amazing. There are some extraordinary places that I have discovered.
Fantastic.
So, head southeast, that would be my recommendation.
That's great. Thank you so much for your time. Pleasure. Roger. That's really fantastic.
I hope there's something that might be of interest there.
Absolutely, to lots of people, yeah. That's great. Thank you.
You weren't writing notes, were you, Harry?
Yeah.
Are you...
well, what a nice interview style cycling. You had. Very nice.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's a real privilege for me. I just get to go around and speak to interesting people.
Everyone's interested. You just got to ask them the right questions, haven't you? Yeah.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Roger Madeline, Head of Canada Water Development at British Land. You can find out more about Roger and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Twitter. You can also send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.